Hello and welcome to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. On this week's show...
I wanted to be really emotional, but I wanted to be totally non-musical. I thought, okay, one of those.
Composer and international DJ David Holmes will be telling Film Weekly why soundtracks are the food of movies and why there's a feast in Cardiff this weekend. And...
most of the time after screenings, people tell me that the first 5 minutes, they really are worried about having to sit through 80 minutes of photographs, but then by minute seven, they forget that they're watching photographs.
Yes, father and son team Alfonso and Jonas Cuaron will be telling us about the young Jonas's innovative debut feature, Año Uña. More of that shortly. And Guardian film critic Zan Brooks will join me to scythe through the week's releases, including Angelina Jolie in Changeling and Robert De Niro in What Just Happened. But first, this week sees the release of Mexican director Jonas Cuaron's debut feature, Año Uña, The Year of the Nail, a story which traces the teenage desires of young Diego in Mexico City as he develops a summer crush on an older American girl, Molly. Jonas's film is immediately notable for two reasons. First, because the project's produced by his father, Alfonso Cuarón, director of Children of Men, Y Tu Mama También, and Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, a father and son team certainly to be reckoned with. And the second reason is because there are no moving images in Año Uña. The entire film is made up of thousands of still photographs taken by Jonas over the year and then overlaid with dialogue. He fashions a story out of his still images collection. So I met up with both Jonas and Alfonso to find out about the film. First, let's hear a sample of Año Uña. And in this scene, American girl Molly wonders why she's not making friends in Mexico City.
I should have gone out to the main campus and made friends with actual Mexicans. But it was hard. If Michelle and the Europeans in class give me shit for being from the U.S., imagine how much shit the Mexican students would have given me. Especially at this university. It has a communist reputation. I don't get it. Mom made so many friends when she traveled through Europe. I guess that was during the 60s.
I'm with Jonas Cuaron and Alfonso Cuaron. I suppose it's Y Tu Papa También. I've been working on that. Jonas, we're here to congratulate you on your the first movie of yours that's coming out in the UK, Año Uña, which is The Year of the Nail. And it's a striking film, a very different film project. Just tell us a bit about how you made it, because it's made up of 1,000 photographs that you've taken, and you've managed to sculpt a narrative through it.
Yeah, well, basically the whole movie is constructed out of still images, but the way I went to do it was kind of the opposite way in which films are normally done. Normally, people write a screenplay first and then pose the images. But in this one, what I was interested in was first capturing the images out of my reality. So I took pictures of family, friends during a year of my life. And at the end, with those photographs, I looked at them and wrote a fictional narrative.
Yeah. So it was a story that the reality suggested to you, but you made the story up. The story's not true.
Yeah, no, the story is not true at all. Like, basically what happened is I took photographs during that year, and most of the photographs were of my girlfriend and my brother. My brother was 13 at that point and my girlfriend around 22, 23. So the narrative ended up being a romantic story between a 13-year-old boy and a 23-year-old girl.
I mean, you were like, I was a bit worried that you were pimping out your brother.
Exactly. Well, that's, most of the characters keep their actual names, but I changed the name of the girl just because it was a little bit awkward having my brother saying things about
pimping
my
out girlfriend. Pimping out your brother and your girlfriend.
Girlfriend, exactly, yeah.
I suppose creatively you've always known that, because I guess that's what directors do with their scripts and with their actors all the time. I mean, Alfonso, you're executive producing on this work for your son Jonas. How did you get involved? Did you see him doing all this and think, I've got to kind of join him?
I have to say that I didn't know he was doing a film until he showed it to me. I knew that he was doing something with photography, but I didn't know he was doing a film. So one day, I was with Michael Ryder for Children of Men, Tim Sexton, and Jonas came and said, can I show you this film? I said, wow, you did a film. I didn't know. Is it a short? He said, no, it's a feature film. I said, okay. And then he started playing the DVD, and the team and I, we turned and said, because it's still photographies, and we turned and said, how long is this? I says, 80 minutes. I says, okay. And it's the last thing we thought about it. Because next we were hooked and connected into the film. We forgot about the still photography.
Because it's interesting. I think everyone will recognize the sort of thing, if they have iPhoto and on their Mac, you do the slideshow and you get the holidays and everything. And here we go, and you can put some music in it. And that's kind of essentially what you've done. But the writing is so good in this film, Jonas, that I was hooked by the story. And I didn't really notice that it was, that it wasn't more storyboarded. I didn't miss the kind of, the in-between bits. So much coverage have you got from your photos.
Yeah, when I started working on this project, I always knew that narrative was going to be very important to like connect to the audience. Most of the time after screenings, people tell me that the first 5 minutes, they really are worried about having to sit through 80 minutes of photographs. But then by minute seven, they forget that they're watching photographs and they're more interested in knowing what's going to happen to the characters. So I think that's something really strong in the movie. The characters are very intriguing and you're very worried about what's going to happen with them, so you can forget that you're watching photographs.
What do you think this shows about the artistic process? Is it a comment on photography? Is it a comment on screenwriting, that one needs to be strong or that the other doesn't have to be strong? I couldn't work out. Maybe both need to be strong, or maybe neither of them matter.
Well, I think in a way both need to be strong, but something I did discover while doing this process is that narrative is at the end what audience connect to the most. But while doing that, I also realized that it is a film that I'm doing, so the way I order the images and the way the images are edited, I do believe try to attempt to cinematic moments.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And if, funnily enough, this is, and I wouldn't say this if your dad wasn't sitting here, but the film it reminded me of me most was Y Tu Mamá También, because they're in Mexico City, you go to a beach, there's horny teenagers talking about jerking off and dreaming about tits. I mean, I know that's what all teenagers do.
No, that's all Mexicans do. Yeah, that's the thing.
I did wonder, or if it was something your dad taught you.
I was pretty amazed with the whole thing, I have to say, my role is the easiest role as an executive producer because he didn't ask for anything. He showed me a film that was already finished. And the only thing I did is he asked me, can you, I would like to talk with Martin Hernandez, who's the sound designer for Alejandro González Iñárritu and Guillermo del Toro. And I put him in touch with Martin, and then Martin fell in love with the whole thing. And it was one of those things in which he asked me for a couple of phone numbers, and he did the rest.
Yeah. Oh, he's got a good mobile phone, yeah. I imagine. But how do you, because as I said, we're familiar with it from iPhoto, and I I go on holiday, I put a little soundtrack to my holiday snaps, but I can't get people to do the talk. How do you do this technically? And I ask this because this is what you're asking people to do as well for a competition.
Well, basically what I did was once I had all the photos, I wrote down the screenplay. And I asked different family members, before I got the sound designer support, they would just come to my house and I had a microphone there.
Like
we're doing now, exactly. And I would record the dialogues, and then in Final Cut Pro, I would put the dialogues together and then start placing the images over those dialogues. And the timing of each photograph changed depending on how long each dialogue was.
So you're now asking people to do this for a very interesting competition that you've dreamed up.
Yeah, well, basically when the movie started touring in festivals, something that I noticed which made me very happy is that the movie inspired young people to do films. They would come out of the screening very happy and telling me that they never realized they could do a film just with their digital camera. So what I came up with was the idea that for the UK release we could have a competition where people could either use my photographs or their own photographs to do short films in the same format.
And so they can do this, and they can download the instruction manual or the kind of how to do it on your website.
Yeah, they can download clips to see how I use the format, and then they also download a package that has a selection of photographs from the film, and then they can just record and do their own story.
So they can use your photographs, or they can do their own?
Well, they can choose to do either mine or their own. And then when I did the movie, what I realized is that the story that I chose to tell is just one of the many stories that you can tell with my photographs. So I'm very interested in seeing what people will choose to tell with my photographs.
You know, most parents would never encourage their children to kind of go on the stage or be an actor, you know, but you obviously don't mind him coming into the film business.
Well, I disencourage him. No, that's what the reason I was surprised, because I disencourage him. and then for some reason, he came out of the closet, and next thing he showed me that he made a film. And the really interesting thing for me, and it speaks about this whole generation, is how, in a way, what he did is he registered reality, and then he turned that reality into fiction. Mm. You know, that is that whole process, I find it very interesting. And yes, I'm very proud, but also very, 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 I really admire this generation, in which, as opposed to our generation that we were whining about how we cannot put together our films and it's so difficult to make a film, they don't ask permission. They just go, take their little cameras, still cameras or telephones, and then you go out and make films.
Muchas gracias, both of you, hijo y padre, and thank you for coming on Film Weekly.
Thank you so much.
Gracias, Jason.
The strangely beguiling Año Uña is out on UK-wide release from Friday, the 28th of November. And if you want to find out more about that competition that Jonas is running to go alongside his film, go to the following website, www.anounacompetition.co.uk. And the executive producer there, Alfonso Cuarón, kindly agreed to be part of my In the Director's Chair series. You can now watch that interview about his career and all those wonderful films that he had part of, Children of Men, The Little Prince, Great Expectations, Y Tu Mama Tambien, of course. That's on now at guardian.co.uk/in the director's chair. You're listening to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons, and joining me now in the film pod is Guardian film critic at large, Zan Brooks. Welcome back, Zan.
Thank you very much.
How are you this week?
I've been all over the shop. Actually, I kind of haven't. I've been slightly desk-bound this week.
Oh, really? Well, I hope you've seen some films for us.
I've seen a few.
Well, that's good, because we're going to discuss Clint Eastwood's new film, Changeling. We're going to discuss Barry Levinson's new film, What Just Happened, and then those Euro art house darlings, the Dardenne brothers, and Le Silence de Lorna, or The Silence of Lorna. Zan, let's start with Clint Eastwood. Changeling stars Angelina Jolie, in case you've had your head buried in the sand and didn't know that. She is upset because the child that's supposed to be her son is given back to her by the LAPD in the 1920s, and she says it's not her son.
It's not my son.
What? What are you saying?
It's not my son.
So you're mistaken?
I'm not mistaken.
Well, he's been through 5 terrible long months. He's lost weight. He's changed.
I wouldn't know my own son.
All I'm saying is you're in shock and he's changed. What's your name? Can you tell me your name?
Walter Collins. It's a common name.
Where do you live, Walter? You know your home address?
I live at 210 Avenue 23, Los Angeles, California. And that's my mommy.
And the 31st film by Clint Eastwood, is he a director to be reckoned with still?
He still is. I think he's becoming the kind of Hollywood equivalent of Philip Roth, isn't he? Having this kind of late bloom in his late 70s.
Love the Leclerc bloom.
Yes.
See what I've done there.
Very good. Very good, Jason. You're on fire this week. So, yeah, this is great. For all its kind of horrors, there's something sort of weirdly comforting about this film, in that it knows exactly what it's doing. It's a very kind of confident, stately, elegant piece of work. It's not perfect, but it's a kind of strong film.
I'm a Clint Eastwood sort of fan of his work.
Yeah.
I mean, in 30 films, I'm not going to like them all. But there was a very telling interview in the Observer Film Quarterly, the last issue, where he sort of said, well, you know, if I've been, you know, a bricklayer who's been doing his job for 50 years, would be quite good at his job now. And as you say, you get the feeling that this guy knows how to make a film.
Yeah, but it never normally works that way, does it? I mean, the sad truth seems to be that filmmakers have kind of maybe 4 or 5 great films in them, and they tend to make them in the first sort of 20 years of working, not towards the end. Mm. I don't think Clint Eastwood has ever been a radical filmmaker. He's never kind of changed the landscape. But he's certainly a very professional, confident one, and Changeling is that.
Let's get into Changeling. So Angelina Jolie, it's 1920s at Los Angeles. She's a roller skating telephone exchange operator whose son disappears.
She's a single mum, you know, and this is a true crime story. It was dug out of the City Hall archives by a journalist called Michael Strizzi. Krasinski, and it is really one of those, you know, truth stranger than fiction stories. It's about Christine Collins, who's a single mum whose son goes missing, and the notoriously kind of corrupt and inept LAPD foist a kind of a changeling on her. And it's this kid who they've kind of, you know, trained across the country. And they, when she protests, they say, you know, take him on a trial run.
It's kind of an extraordinary scene, isn't it?
It's fantastic. And then when she inevitably kicks up a stink, she's seen as a kind of barking mad mum and an unfit mother, and eventually kind of tossed in a mental institution.
Where she last won an Oscar for Girl
exactly,
Interrupted.
This is her natural home, isn't it, for Jolie, is the mental institution. And this perhaps is where the actress slightly goes off the rails in more ways than one. I think that she gives a very, very good performance in Changeling. And yet, you know, you throw into Bedlam and she inevitably starts sort of chewing the scenery a little bit.
Yeah.
Also, the problem with her is that she never looks like anything other than a film star.
I have a problem with Angelina Jolie's celebrity in this. Yeah. I cannot get over the fact that, I mean, they keep calling her Christine Collins as if to kind of convince us that it's Christine Collins. I mean, they
really
use the character
Angelina.
Name a lot. But I just could not stop thinking, that's Angelina Jolie. Yeah. I don't know if that's because I first saw it in Cannes and she was there on the red carpet and she was there doing Kung Fu Panda and the single mum thing and the Brangelina thing. Do you think sometimes that the power of celebrity can tip the balance? Maybe I should fast forward 30 years and view it then.
Yeah, it's the sort of star wattage has a way of kind of, you know, sort of blasting out everything around it. And that's certainly the problem with Jolly, and is probably getting increasingly so. You know, even when she's in a straitjacket, she looks great. It's like a sort of straitjacket designed by the top designer in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And that does get in the way of the film.
Yeah. I did have a bit of a problem with it. I didn't really love it. I have to say, I didn't really love Million Dollar Baby either.
I prefer this to Million Dollar Baby.
I think there's something. I mean, I do like Clint's kind of smooth, kind of woodwork kind of thing.
Yes.
The handsome crafting. Yeah. Well. I just thought there were some sort of ticks in here. There's like a cigarette ash dropping on the floor as the cop listens to the horrific story. There's certain sort of Eastwoodian tics that just in this one didn't, they sort of broke the spell rather than continued it for me. And I kept sort of thinking it was slightly sort of TV movie of the week in a way.
It's certainly a solid verging on the plodding film at times. It doesn't kind of electrify you. The subject matter, I think, is dynamite. I think the subject matter is great. And maybe a more imaginative director would have kind of brought that out more and made it kind of swing more. And as you say, this is a very kind of solid piece of carpentry. I liked it. I found it sort of oddly reassuring. It's like this sort of the master narrative and the master filmmaker who's kind of like, you know, leading you through the story.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't hate it. I just thought, I was a bit bored by it in a way. I'd seen it all before. I'd see all of
There's
the corrupt
always
cops,
enough going
the LA,
on there.
The kind of period detail. I just thought it was a bit too tidy for its own good for such an emotive story.
There's enough going on there that I was never bored. I think that there's kind of enough horrors in there. The sort of the serial killer element, which comes in towards the end, I thought was very well done. The slightly kind of spooky thing of children. You know, it's ironic that in a film that is basically kind of glorifying Jolie as the perfect mum, and that's her struggle, that it has this kind of weird undercurrent of creepy kids. And I thought that played well. It's not a film that brings those to fruition particularly, and that maybe that's not what Eastwood is trying to do or is able to do, but it still worked for me.
Watch out for it in award season nonetheless, despite what I think. Let's stay in Los Angeles, but in the modern day, for a film called What Just Happened. It's the new film by Academy Award winner Barry Levinson. Stars Robert De Niro as a put-upon producer who's trying to get a film made, starring Sean Penn and re-edited. He's also trying to get Bruce Willis to shave off his beard.
Talk to me.
You're not going
to
believe it. He's fat.
Bruce Willis is overweight?
With a Grizzly Adams beard.
If that bastard doesn't shave and look like a leading man, we sue you for misrepresentation.
Aw, Sidney, come on. Audiences want to know it's you, Bruce.
What are you talking about? They're not going to recognize me, Ben? Oh, where'd Bruce go? Oh, look, there he is. I see him right there, the guy with the beard.
Yeah, well, why don't we start by giving your overblown stomach to the Red Cross?
Ben, what just happened?
What just happened was that a real-life film producer called Art Linson wrote a book about 6 years ago called What Just Happened, and now they've gone and done a movie of it. So it's art imitating life, imitating art.
So something. Hollywood memoirs, that sort of thing. We're backstage. We're in the film lot. We're in player territory.
We are in player territory, and by God, it feels like that. And it's never quite the same when you beat back on the same path, I guess. Remakes are never as good as the original, surely.
Is it that bad? Is it that remake, or is it just that we've seen all this before?
We've seen all it before. That's not to say it's bad. It's perfectly entertaining. It's got a lot of kind of funny elements to it. It just struck me as a little bit like one of those celebrity roastings that they have in Hollywood, where the great and the good kind of yuck it up and kind of poke gentle fun at each other. And it's wonderfully hilarious for them. But for anybody watching, you kind of think, well, you know.
Because you've got the cameos, you've got the Bruce Willis, you've got Sean Penn sort of playing themselves. But then in the meantime, you've got Catherine Keener, you've got Robin Wright Penn playing actual fictional characters. There's a strange disclaimer at the end saying all the people in this film are fictitious. But, I mean, Bruce Willis isn't fictitious.
Bruce Willis isn't fictitious. But basically, he's playing Alec Baldwin, apparently, because in the book, it's Alec Baldwin was the movie star who refuses to shave off his beard. And you kind of think, why couldn't they have got Alec Baldwin to play
himself? Because
Alec
Baldwin's career is kind of on the up again now, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah, so just do that.
Yeah. De Niro wasn't quite right for me. I don't like De Niro doing comedy particularly. He's not
Meet the
Sam
Parents is wonderful.
Do you think so?
I love Meet the Parents.
I don't like him. He gives me the creeps, actually. And here again, not quite like, there's a lot of De Niro in his underpants walking around being divorced. There's a lot of John Turturro in his underpants, which is way worse. I'd rather see Nanni Moretti without his underpants.
This is when they're off in Hollywood. Yeah. They wander around in their underpants, cutting deals.
And he who wears boxers is slightly higher up the chain than he who wears briefs, it seems.
I think so, and he who wears nothing is on the way out. I mean, it's one of those films that doesn't kind of add up to more than the sum of its parts, and yet the sum of its parts is very good. I really like John Turturro as the sort of the nervy agent who's actually sort of scared of his clients. And, you know, Bruce Willis as the diva who won't shave off his beard and has a sort of furious temper. And the kind of the weird little aside of Sean Penn's kind of art house film where it tests badly because his dog gets shot in the end, so they want to recut the film and the director refuses. And so all of that is kind of fun. It's just a little bit limp and a little bit kind of we've seen it before.
Yeah.
And it kind of, it's almost like pleading for us to have, you know, a bit of sympathy for the producer. And frankly, I can't.
The actual drama involved doesn't really have any kind of humor. Element to it. You don't actually feel for any of the characters. Unlike
not
in the player, you really do feel for Griffin.
Yeah.
And you do care. And there's one thing in these things that they always try and make up names of movies, like East of Hell and Miami Moon. And they're never really as funny as the movies that actually that we have themselves. And there's always a funny pitch, like it's kind of the Rose Bowl Parade meets the Da Vinci Code set in the florists. And you think, well, that's just so ridiculous that it would never get made anyway.
Yeah, and these are the people who should know that world better than anyone. And they're kind of coming up with these, sort of like sixth form kind of jokes, which maybe says something very revealing about who's running Hollywood.
That's what just happened. Let's move on to another film that premiered at Cannes back in May and now breaks upon our shores. It's by the Dardenne brothers, Jean-Pierre and Luc, the Belgian art house favourites who've won two Palme d'Ors. Their latest won the screenplay prize at Cannes. It's called The Silence of Lorna and stars Jérémy Régnier and Arthur de Brochy. Zan, here they are on the margins of society once more. Drug addicts, single mothers, pregnant mothers, mafiosi. Is the Dardenne spell as strong as ever?
No. I'm worried that we're being very tepid about all the films that are out this week. They're all a bit middling. And this one is, I think...
You like The Changeling more than me.
I did like The Changeling. I like The Changeling more than Silence of Lorna. I quite like the Dardenne brothers, but I'm getting a bit wearied of them.
It's very interesting that you say this because, I mean, Rosetta, which won their first Palme d'Or, I thought was terrific, spellbinding, couldn't take my eyes off the creature. The Sun, starring Oliver Gourmet, brilliant again. Then the last one that won the Palme d'Or again, L'Enfant, the Child, I was like, do you know what? I'm kind of a bit used to their kind of their techniques. Is it the fact that they just shoot these films in such stark, staring, realistic camera gazes? Or is it the fact that you just think, well, you know, do you really care about all these poor people? What is it that's wearing thin?
The weird thing about this is that I think they're actually trying to do something a bit different. They're trying to kind of marry their sort of stark social realist art house gaze with with a kind of genre thriller. And this has Lorna, who's an Albanian, who's sort of involved in this passport scam with kind of Russian gangsters that ends up, you know, threatening the life of the Belgian drug addict who she's married as part of this scam. So it's this real kind of high concept thing that they're trying to do here, and it just doesn't fit.
Yeah, I don't think it fits with a kind of humane plea for our compassion about these people on the margins of
Not
society.
Not at all. So then it just kind of annoys both sides. It annoys the people who want to go and see a film about Russian gangsters in Belgium, you know, that crowd.
And then there's the three of them walking past the window now.
Well, then it offends the kind of the perhaps the three people that will go and see a Dardenne Brothers film because it's stark social realist art house. I mean, the kind of the big influence for the Dardenne Brothers has always been Robert Bresson. I mean, Rosetta was basically a kind of slight remake of Mouchette.
Yeah.
And this one is like a remake of sort of Bresson's crime thrillers like Pickpocket or L'Argent. And yet Bresson's crime thrillers still had this kind of great existential kind of angst and confidence and knew what they were doing. Whereas this, you kind of feel that they're not in their natural milieu and they're sort of casting around and overcomplicating.
Well, when I came out of it in Cannes and said, God, I really thought that was quite rubbish, actually, because it was to me as if I'd been watching The Wizard of Oz for the last couple of movies. Then the curtain was pulled back and I just saw the workings. And I just didn't believe them anymore. I just thought, well, they said, well, let's make another one. What else can we do now? What other poor people in Belgium?
You can't
can we
say
find?
That to certain people, and you certainly can't say that to certain people in Cannes. I mean, that's heresy.
It was. I mean, I was lucky I wasn't burned at the stake like Robert De Niro or something in what just happened. But that is The Silence of Lorna, over which I think we will draw perhaps a discreet veil of silence.
Fade the volume.
Zan Brooks, thank you very much. Of course, you can catch up with Zan's views and reviews at www. How many W's is that? I think I'll give you four. Of course,
yeah, just won another one last week.
Maybe Oliver Stone lent you his, because God knows no one else knew what to do with it. www.guardian.co.uk/film. It's Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and now to music. Music, said the great director and guest on this show last week, Fernando Morales, is the soul of a film. And with this in mind, the cream of British musicians and filmmakers are gathering in the Welsh capital, Cardiff, for the first Soundtrack International Film and Music Festival. One of the participants at the festival is David Holmes, who, alongside his renown as a DJ and producer and composer, has also established a career scoring for films such as The Recent Hunger by Steve McQueen and Ocean's 11, 12 and 13. What you're hearing now is an extract from Ocean's 12 entitled What Are We Stealing? And joining me on the line now is the composer of this lovely tune. Welcome to Film Weekly, David Holmes. Now, you're going to be down in Cardiff to have a look at your work as a film soundtrack composer, David. Is this where you always imagined your career going when you were DJing those sweaty nights in Belfast?
No, not at all. I mean, I kind of got into it by accident, really. I mean, I kind of felt maybe it was just something, I don't know, natural within my own work as a producer that I didn't even, you know, it wasn't contrived. You know, for example, when I started making tunes with just sort of samplers and drum machines and stuff, my influences were very cinematic influences, like, you know, Midnight Cowboy and Once Upon a Time in America and old John Carpenter kind of films, the more sort of electronic side of early 70s kind of film music.
And is that because they're the films you grew up with and it was the images that abide, or is it the sounds that kind of, you know, when he used Harry Nilsson in Midnight Cowboy, did that kind of chime with you? Is it the mix of music and image that sticks in your mind? Because when I've always got your albums and your free associations, they take me on a quite cinematic journey, actually.
Well, a lot of those soundtracks, I sort of, you know, I inherited Midnight Cowboy just from, I've got like many brothers and sisters, so at a very early age I was inheriting music. But they actually just stood alone for me outside the movie. And then when I just started getting into production, I just started using, you know, things like that as a reference and an inspiration. And then when my records actually started to get reviewed, people were saying, oh, you know, your music's really cinematic. And I didn't even think that I was trying to make something cinematic. So it just kind of stuck.
How much of it do you think it comes from your work as a producer, and how much of it comes from that live work that you do as a DJ when you're doing a set in a club and you're taking people on what I always think is quite a cinematic journey?
Well, I mean, it's a very, very good point, and you're totally sort of, you know, hit the nail on the head. I kind of feel as if my work as a DJ totally informs my work as, you know, a soundtrack producer. And I kind of feel as if the two of them really complement and inform each other. When you're out playing, especially, I mean, the DJ gigs I like to do these days that I'm really passionate about is like 5-hour set, sitting in a very tiny space with 200 people with a video screen, showing movies that I want and playing the music that I want, but with no dance floor. So I'm able to kind of really experiment and go off and play classical music and play soundtracks and play even things as kind of avant-garde as Music Concrete.
We did a soundtrack show here in conjunction with the Observer Music Monthly about a year ago, and there was a lot of arguing between the kind of traditional music guys who were kind of going, well, it has to be Ennio Morricone, it has to be composed entirely for a film, you know, that was the grounds. And I was arguing that, you know, a kind of mashup of a mix of composition and a mix of choices, that's what makes up a soundtrack these days.
That's what life is. Do you know what I mean? Exactly what you've just said. That's what life is. I mean, I just seen this great sort of documentary on Sky Arts. It was like sort of emotions through music and film by Martin Scorsese. And he basically said, you know, when he lived in Elizabeth Street in the 50s and 60s, like, you know, he would be sort of like hanging out of his, like, you know, his apartment window. He would look out of his apartment window. And obviously that sort of like Lower East Side of New York, there was a lot of action. There was a lot of people on the streets. He said, you'd look out and some guy would be getting the shit kicked out of him and Fats Domino would be playing. And then across in the restaurant, the Italian restaurant across the street, you'd have, you know, opera would be sort of blurring out. And he says, that is just life as I've seen it.
I detect that influence in Steven Soderbergh's work. How did you first get kind of caught by him and asked to do the work for the Ocean series, for example, which is a great mix of kind of, you know, I love, you know, the choice of Perry Como in there and the choice of, you know, a bit of Elvis Presley and then a bit of music that you've composed yourself. How did you kind of go through those? Because things have changed through 11, 12 and 13. How have you worked with him on those?
Well, I made an album called Let's Get Killed, which involved me sort of traveling around the streets of New York out of my mind on LSD with a DAT machine recording every freak that I could get my hands on.
And I wondered why I liked that album so much.
So he heard that record and then hired me for Out of Sight, and then I'd done that and then Oceans came along, and, you know, I would never have done Oceans if I hadn't done Out of Sight.
Your recent work, which I was so surprised when I saw your credit when I first saw the film Hunger at the Cannes Film Festival back in May, and it's now had a much acclaimed release. Tell me about your involvement in that, because that's totally different. You're back on kind of home turf, a Belfast story, obviously a political nightmare minefield, and a film that you wouldn't suggest that music would be perhaps such a vital part of it, but you've done some very subtle work there with Steve McQueen. Tell us about that collaboration and how, you know, close it was to you politically.
The first film I ever done was Resurrection Man, the Mark Evans film.
With Stuart Townsend.
Which was like loosely based on the Shankill Butchers. But when I first heard about Hunger, you know, because listen, no one hates more than I do a bad film made about Northern Ireland, and there's been a few. So I actually called up the producer and asked him. I just said, I have to work on this film, I grew up through this. I feel it. I live here. I do music for film. Blah blah blah. And they says, okay, well, we'll send you a script. So they sent me the script, and I read the script, and then I kind of thought about it. And I rang them back, and I basically said, like, I got to be totally honest with you. I actually think your film doesn't need any music. Because I think all the music is already in the scripts. The music was in the silence and the atmosphere and the kind of just the imagery that he was kind of, that he was getting, you know, and what I could see and what I could hear. And he actually turned around and said to me, we should talk, because Steve thinks that, but he thinks that it maybe needs one thing. So he came round to my house and we talked, and, you know, I told him, look, if you bring strings or anything into this film, it's just going to fucking ruin it, you know?
Absolutely.
I mean, this is a piece of art, that you're, you know? And he says, I couldn't agree with you more, but it needs one thing, and it kind of, I feel as if... I says, well, what kind of emotional space do you see the music in? And he says, well, I want it to be really emotional, but I want it to be totally non-musical. I said, okay, one of those. So I had this track that I'd been working on for my album called Any City with a Dirty History. And it actually wasn't about Belfast. It was actually about an experience I had in New York and a long time ago. And there was one piece, there was one instrument in it that actually just droned the whole way through, which the actual instrument was a hurdy-gurdy that most people will recognize as the droning sound that you hear through Venus and Furs by Velvet Underground.
Yep.
So I soloed that one instrument, and he just went, that is the soundtrack right there. That is the main body of the soundtrack. And then we just sort of developed it from there. I mean, that was a complete fluke. But that's the way things are when you're working in films.
And I thank you very much for joining us
on
the show. And enjoy Cardiff, and may they enjoy your music. Thanks very much, David Holmes.
Thanks a lot, man.
And that festival in Cardiff runs from November the 26th to the 29th. And for more information, go to the festival's very own website, www.soundtrackfilmfestival.com. That's all, I'm afraid, for this week. A big thanks to all of my guests, to David Holmes, to Jonas and Alfonso Cuarón, and to Zan Brooks, of course. Do pick up an Observer this Sunday to catch my Trailer Trash column, and why not join me on Facebook? Hey, kids. Film Weekly Fans is our group. We're keen to hear all your views on the films we review and the films of 2008. We're storing up your thoughts. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer as ever, Jason Phipps, until next week, goodbye.